Welcome to CrimeWire, the place for information, news, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in any time during the show tonight at 646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room right here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or family member who would like to send CrimeWire information on an unsolved or suspicious death case, or have a specific crime-related topic you'd like to have discussed on a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. Kim Colton is manning the switchboard tonight. Hiya, Kim.
Hey, Denny. It's good to be here tonight. A very exciting show.
I'm anxious to get going here. Tonight, yep. We're going to be talking again about Bugsy Siegel. And on the night of June 20th, 1947, notorious mobster Benjamin Bugsy Siegel was relaxing in the living room of his girlfriend Virginia Hill's mansion in Beverly Hills, and conveniently for her, she was away on vacation in Paris. But his trusted friend Al Smiley was with him. Suddenly, rifle shots rang out from outside the living room window. Two of the slugs struck Siegel in the face. One of them ejected his left eye, which was found on the floor some 15 feet away from the body. Bugsy was dead at the age of 41. Speculation swirled as to who killed Siegel and why. The most popular theory at the time was that the gangster had gotten in hot water with his organized crime pals over his handling or mishandling of the Flamingo Casino project in Las Vegas. Whatever the reason for the murder, no one was ever charged in connection with Siegel's death, and it remains one of the more intriguing cold cases. However, in 2012, some 65 years after the killing, a man has emerged who he believes knows who pulled the trigger that night, circumstances surrounding Siegel's death. That man is Warren Hull. For the past 6 years, Warren has served as the executive assistant to the chief of police for the Clark County School District Police Department in Las Vegas. Prior to coming to Las Vegas, he was a secondary school and college teacher and administrator. He's a former member of the Naval Security Group and National Security Agency, and is pursuing a doctoral degree in public policy administration with an emphasis in homeland security. In addition, for the past 16 years, Warren has been researching the murderer, Benjamin Siegel. And on November 27th, Warren was a guest on CrimeWire and presented part one of his theory of who really killed Siegel and the motive behind the murder. Tonight, Warren is back to finish the story and take your calls or questions from the chat room. So if you agree, disagree with him, or have your own opinion, we'd like to hear from you. Warren, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Denny. Nice to be here.
Last time, 2 weeks ago, I believe we mentioned that you had said that, in your opinion, Robert McDonald was the actual trigger man in the Siegel murder. And he had ties to some of the wealthy in Los Angeles, and also some of the unsavory people, such as Jack Dragna, who was the crime boss at that time. And you had given us some of the background of who was who and the key players. And we ended up, I believe, talking about Mr. McDonald's son, or son of a record anyway, John McDonald. And there's some possibility that perhaps Howard Hughes came into play in this whole relationship. Is that about where we were?
Yeah, we're pretty close to that. And the Howard Hughes piece, and with John, I know John's listening tonight. I know Kim took a look at the Facebook photo that compares Howard Hughes and John McDonald, and yeah. I think it was pretty jaw-dropping for her. Kim, you want to throw something in there?
Yeah, it was. It was. It would be nice to actually have the DNA. It would be great. But look at those pictures, the side-by-sides, and also the interview you did with John, and there's no question. There is.
Speaking of that, before we go on, Warren, why don't you again give the website information where people?
Oh, and sure. I did post it in the chat room, but please go ahead.
Good deal. We just have a family secret page on Facebook right now. And what I did specifically for the show and for some friends and family who are asking is we put a lot of the pictures that are involved in this story on that Facebook page. So just go to Family Secret on Facebook. And if you want to like the page, that's great. If you want to just kind of peruse through there and take a look at the photographs, you really get a good visual. And Denny, as you know, I really like giving the visual on this story because it is so powerful, and even so much more so with the photographs. So if you get a chance, take a peek at the photos, and it really does paint a great picture. Now, in regard to tonight, what I'd like to do is just kind of pick up where we left off, and that was, you know, we've laid the foundation with Robert McDonald and Betty Ann McDonald's parents and how powerful these two individuals were. Archie McDonald, for those who haven't heard the first one and just tuned in tonight, he was basically Howard Hughes's right-hand man. He was known as the guardian of the empire, the Hughes empire, back in the 20s and 30s, and was with Hughes throughout his entire career. And basically, about this time frame that we're talking, Archie's role was designated to being the fixer and keeping Hughes's secrets. And I think we're going to find out that he had a pretty big secret. And the amazing thing is all these things are going to connect at the end to give us an answer as to why the Siegel murder was never really resolved officially. Betty Ann's mother, who was Robert's wife, was Gunnell Moretta. And I always called my Aunt Gunnell, my Aunt Gay, probably the first woman of organized crime in L.A. She was one of the most powerful females that I've ever come across in research. And she's probably the most least known, or at least known by almost everybody, because of the life that she led. She was tied to the Shaw regime back in Los Angeles when Franklin Shaw was the mayor and ran what is arguably one of the most corrupt political machines in history. She was tied to all the law enforcement agencies that worked during that time. Again, very, very corrupt. And, you know, there's some great shows coming out about that era, Gangster Squad's coming out. L.A. Noir is going to be a series. So the era is really picking up, and it's going to be very, very interesting for people to see. But I think where I left off was we had just started to talk about this romance between Betty Ann Rockwell and Robert McDonald. And this it is really a tragedy because this should have been one of those fairy tale type stories. You had two people from incredible wealth and power and luxury and just they had everything going for them. And they met as teens. They met in the late 1930s, 1939 to be exact. And their relationship really starts to take off in the early 40s. And I try to give perspective to people by saying that Betty Ann is the kind of gal who could close down the Coconut Grove and give Bob McDonald the going away party when he goes to school. Now, take a look at Aviator and the big scene with Howard Hughes where they're dancing and they got the music playing. That's the Coconut Grove. So this is the kind of money and clout that these families come from. Very, very fairy tale-ish. Another great thing in there that I came across, compliments of John McDonald, actually, is we talked a little bit about the people that they hung out with. And I have a great article from the 40s that Bob McDonald is engaged in this dance competition at the Beverly Hills Hotel, and it becomes a standoff. But they finally give the award of best couple to Bob and his date because it's a bottle of champagne. And the reason they didn't give it to the other person is it's Shirley Temple. So, you know, they're working in this great social circle that is just incredible. And it's just one thing after another that is going in a very, very positive direction. Well, in July of 1940, Ralph Applegate, who was married to Gunnell, and if you remember, Gunnell had married Ralph Applegate when she was with Mayor Shaw's regime. Ralph was the man who kind of facilitated her escape and gave her that social validity. He was a man of great wealth. He was an investment broker. And July of 1940, Ralph Applegate is killed in a car accident. He crashes head-on into one of the R streetcars, the big streetcars that ran through downtown L.A. What a lot of people didn't know is the reason Ralph crashed into that car was that he had come home that evening and discovered that Gunnell was in bed with Nick Moretta. And go back to the 20s. Nick Moretta was the one who facilitated the meeting between Gunnell's first husband, Rennie Rockwell, and Jack Dragna. Nick Moretta is a very, very good friend of the Dragnas and had been since 1918, 1919. That's another one of our family secrets. This relationship, and I come to know my Nick Moretta as my Uncle Nick, not knowing that technically I had two other uncles before him, but Uncle Nick is the reason why this tragedy occurs. Getting back to the McDonald's, getting back to Bob McDonald and Betty Ann, they continue their fairy tale relationship. They yacht on Howard Hughes' yacht over to Catalina. They dance. They spend time together. They spend their first Christmas together. And then in January of 1941, Howard Hughes flies Bob McDonald and Betty Ann up to Northern California to Santa Clara University, where Bob is going to be enrolled at the University of Santa Clara. During this time, he has a connection with Betty Ann. So Howard Hughes, if you know anything about Howard Hughes, he was a big advocate of young girls. And this is where I think Hughes kind of was intrigued with Betty Ann. If you look at the photographs of Betty Ann on that site, she is an incredibly beautiful young lady. She's also 17 years old. One thing leads to another. January, Bob is dropped off at school. In March, a wedding announcement is made. Betty Ann is going to be marrying Robert McDonald. This comes in March of 1941. In June of 1941, the McDonalds are married. In November of 1941, John McDonald is born. This creates a problem for Bob McDonald. And the problem is a timing problem. Being born in late November would equate to the conception taking place in late February. Bob McDonald was in school at the time of John's conception. He went up. He was in school in January. We've got his school records that indicate that. Now, could Betty Ann have gone up visiting him? Absolutely, she could have. But when you look at things that come up later down the road, particularly that side-by-side photo of John and Howard Hughes, we can kind of piece things together that way. Betty Ann confesses to a couple of family members, one of which is my mom, who's Betty Ann's cousin, that the father of her child may be Howard Hughes. She never came out and said that it was, but she confesses, I had an affair with Howard Hughes. This creates a problem right away in the McDonald relationship, and understandably so. Regardless of if Howard Hughes is the father or not, the possibility is that he could have been. And now we're dealing with an unwed mother. She's pregnant. She's a Catholic. Big, big issues in 1940 LA, 1940 in general. This, I think, is the impetus of why their relationship, the McDonald relationship, is so turbulent over the years. It is very bad from the start. Hope, do I have you?
You're here. Go ahead.
Oh, okay, good. I had a little static there. But that's why I think the relationship was so turbulent over the years, and now it makes sense. And that was one of those things where, you know, they arranged the marriage, basically, is what happens here. Archie is the ultimate fixer. Hughes has gotten a woman pregnant. That woman happens to be his son's daughter, or his son's wife or girlfriend at the time. He needs to fix this, and he needs to fix it quick, because Hughes can go to jail for this. He had that appetite for the young girl in his life. Now, the other thing that's just so fascinating here is that later on we would discover that after they received their vows, each person in that marriage, Bob and Betty Ann, received $100,000, and that is a low-end estimate. In some of the newspaper clippings that we have, they actually named the figure that Betty Ann left to the kids, and it was $100,000, and we think it was a little bit more than that. But the payoff for keeping the Hughes child a secret was $200,000, which in 1940 is just a staggering amount of money. Just very, very incredible. As time passes now, we're talking a very, very short period of time after the wedding, things in Bob McDonald's life understandably go south. He's in a marriage with a woman that he absolutely adores and loves, but who probably has a child with another man. Tough position to be in. When I found out some of these elements, when I first discovered this story, I really wasn't a big fan of Bob McDonald's at all. But as the story evolved, I kind of started feeling sorry for him. You know, he's a 18, 19-year-old kid. He's living in Howard Hughes' shadow. His father is dealing with Hughes all the time. And now his love of his life is pregnant. It's a great kid, and now it could maybe be somebody else's. And he's trying to live with that and deal with that. He doesn't do a very good job about it. We hit World War II, and this is where we pick up the story and we pick up the pace a little bit, because I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on the war years or what follows immediately afterwards. But a fascinating time. Again, get in and take a look at the website, because we do have a lot of cool pictures during this era. But a few months after John McDonald's born, the world's at war, and so too are the McDonald's. They just are always fighting. They're always bickering. They're always going back and forth. Early 1942 is also when Gunnell marries Nick Moretta. So Rennie Rockwell has died in 1930. That's Betty Ann's father. Ralph Applegate was her stepfather. He dies in 1940. And now my Aunt Gay marries the man who I become, or who I know as my Uncle Nick. So she's on husband number three. Now, Nick is connected very, very strongly to Jack Dragnus. So keep that in mind as we progress through the story, is that Gunnell's connected to Dragnus since about 1922, 23, and Nick is connected to the Dragnus family since about 1919. By early 1942, people are trying to work things out. Bob McDonald has a really bad day. He snaps. And it's the first time that he physically beats Betty Ann. And my mom was a witness to that first beating, and that was 1942, I want to say probably November. It was early November, late October. And if you've ever seen The Godfather, there's a scene where Sonny goes out and beats up the brother-in-law that had beat Talia Shire's character. Mm-hmm. With the Sicilians, you don't hurt the women. That's just the way that it is. Jack Dragna had known Betty Ann his entire life. Nick Moretta, at Gunnell's urging, that they don't know what to do about this now, because now the situation is getting very, very bad. Nick goes to Jack, complains about Bob. Bob is spoken to by a few of the boys and is basically nudged a little bit and said, don't ever let this happen again. This isn't acceptable. It doesn't work. He has another incident a couple weeks later, but this time, before anybody can do anything, Bob McDonald goes off and joins the Army. He joins in 1942. Now, this is a guy from a family of tremendous wealth. No reason he should be going into the Army. Could have easily gotten out of it. In fact, later on he becomes a commissioned officer when Archie decides this is a good thing for him. He's going to man up. Maybe he'll grow up, and this could be good for him. So they support him with this, and Betty Ann supports him with this. So he joins the Army, and he becomes a combat infantry rifle lieutenant. He's leading a rifle squad. This becomes important. Thanks to John McDonald, after I met him, we have a number of letters from his father of paper back to mom and dad and back to the family. And one fascinating one that really causes people to drop their jaws a little bit is the letter that he sends home, and he talks about the situation involving a couple of weapons. And if you remember going to the Siegel murder, I talked about two weapons that were in the FBI report that could have possibly been used. The first was a carbine, and then the second one was a Tommy gun or a submachine gun of a .45 caliber. We have got a handwritten letter from Bob to his mom or dad, and he says, by the way, the gun parts won't be coming in for a while as I need to use them. The last action I had, I carried two pistols, one carbine, and my Tommy gun. Tommy gun is a submachine gun, 45 caliber.
Jenny?
Yes, did we lose Warren?
Oh, I think we did. I think we lost Warren.
Let's talk while we're waiting for him to call back in.
Okay.
When Warren first told me the story,
mm-hmm.
it was, you know, just absolutely fascinating to me with the characters. And it's really difficult to keep track of everyone. I mean, there's a lot of players involved, but when you get this thing all pieced together, and those photos to me were like the one you saw with John McDonald, a comparison with Howard Hughes.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly is very compelling evidence.
It is, and when you can even with Robert McDonald, he doesn't look a thing like him. I mean, nothing.
No,
so,
there's absolutely no question. Well.
Whatsoever. Right.
Sort of a DNA test, I'm saying, but as far
right.
as visual,
mm-hmm.
there can be little question as to, at least in my mind, that there's some relationship there between John McDonald and Howard Hughes. I can't see anyone having those features just kind of by accident or coincidence. So that is compelling, and, you know, Another thing is when you think about mob hits, you almost always come up with either, you know, the close range handgun, bullet behind the ear, maybe in some cases a bomb or some type of explosive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Once in a while, in a torture type murder, a stabbing, ice pick type thing. But rifles or machine guns, I mean, you go back to the Capone days, when you used to see these Roaring Twenties movies and stuff, you know, where the commie gun was coming into play. But as far as after that, the mob hits, you don't hear much about rifles or commie guns being involved. So that is another thing when you think about it.
Oh.
It's kind of an odd situation. Okay, I think maybe Warren's back.
Hey, Warren.
Hey, I must have dropped you. Where did I leave you off at?
Well,
talking about the handwritten letter that Robert wrote was about the gun parts.
Yeah.
Okay, good. I'm glad you picked that up. I don't know how I lost you there. Welcome to Henderson, Nevada, and living near Black Hill. Okay. The gun parts he was going to ship home, and he really comes back from the war as a war hero. I had mentioned while I was obviously talking to myself the fact that Bob McDonald had a situation in a small town in Germany where he was so despondent he actually tried to commit suicide, and he did so by expecting himself to get killed by German rifle fire. And he drives down this cobblestone street with a bike with just the rims on it, throwing grenades into the German strongholds. And what happens is he turns out being a war hero. He saves his command, he saves his men, he gets a Purple Heart, a Bronze Star, a Silver Star. And really, if it wasn't for him, a lot of people would have died. So he comes back from World War II, and when he does, the family gets together and they say, we've got to make this work. And all parties agree that they're going to try to give the marriage a second shot. They're going to let bygones be bygones. They're going to put their best foot forward. After all, they are people of quality. They're people of money. They're people of status. I talked a little bit about what was going on in L.A. during the time, and it was a very festive time. And for Betty Ann, it was probably the best time of her life. She was raising her young son. She was able to do things. She was free from the threat of violence. So all in all, it was a good thing. We're going to backtrack just a little bit to get to the Flamingo, because now the Flamingo Hotel comes into play. And Denny, you can't answer this question because I know we covered it and you know the answer. But Kim, I'm going to ask you, who invented the Flamingo?
Who invented the Flamingo? Was it Bugsy?
It
Did
was
he have a vision?
Not Bugsy Siegel. myth, and that's okay because people really don't understand the story. They saw Warren Beatty's portrayal of Bugsy Siegel on the big screen, and that's one of the things that we have as a problem when you try to research and investigate is people believe that Hollywood myth. I ask 10 people who invented the flamingo, and they go, Bugsy Siegel. It wasn't Bugsy Siegel. It was actually Billy Wilkerson. Now, Billy Wilkerson was the man who was behind the Hollywood Reporter. Billy Wilkerson was the man behind Ciro's. Billy Wilkerson was the man behind the Trocadero Club. So he was the original visionary. That great scene where Warren Beatty and Annette Bening are in the car with Mickey Cohen and they go out to the desert and Siegel has a vision for the flamingo, didn't happen.
Yep. Okay.
Didn't happen. So, you know, those are some of the facts that get skewed along the way. Now, Siegel has tremendous influence over it, and we're going to quickly go through that because that in itself is a fantastic story. But Billy Wilkerson is the guy. He's from the Hollywood Reporter. He's a bad gambler, and his buddies all tell him, look, Billy, you lose a lot of money gambling. You need to own the place so that you can, you know, lose more money if you want. So Wilkerson finds this piece of property out in Vegas here, and he ends up purchasing the property. He goes to Bank of America, and his best friend and now business partner, Howard Hughes, and he asks Bank of America for $600,000, Howard Hughes for $800,000, and he breaks ground on the Flamingo in November of 1945. So a lot of people don't realize the connection that these Hollywood folks all had. Ben Siegel, Billy Wilkerson, Howard Hughes, Gene Harlow, all the stars of the time, they all know each other. It's a very tight community. And
George Raft.
George Raft was in Howard Hughes' Scarface. That's probably how Hughes met Maya Lansky for the first time. I know that he met Charlie Luciano for the first time in the 30s. We've got that one pretty well documented. Hughes was dating a starlet named Thelma Todd, as was Luciano at the same time. So another story.
Another story.
Just a great story. Yes, all good stuff. But this stuff is so fascinating.
OMG.
February of 1946, though, Wilkerson screws up, and the Flamingo comes to a stop. Construction comes to a halt again. Long story short on the Flamingo, the mob gets involved. They say, we'll help you finish your hotel, but we need to have a front guy come in, and the front guy is Ben Siegel. So Wilkerson has known Siegel for years and years, and if you look on the Facebook page, you'll see some pictures of Billy Wilkerson and Ben Siegel together. Drucker's Barbershop. There's a great picture of the two of them at Drucker's. It was in the Hollywood Reporter. So they have this long friendship. Now, Wilkerson doesn't know much about Siegel. He knows that he's a mobster. He knows that he's this, but he's always been very cordial. They've always had a good relationship. So he agrees to this deal. Turns out being bad. As this relationship goes and they start to build this thing, they just run into conflict after conflict after conflict, and Siegel becomes Benny Siegel. He starts to power Wilkerson off the project. He wants him off. And Wilkerson fights it at first, and then eventually the conflict gets so bad that Siegel basically considers taking Wilkerson out. I'm going to kill him if he doesn't get off this project. And, you know, that's it for poor Billy Wilkerson. You know, he's going to go back to Hollywood. He's still going to manage the hotel by the contract. Hughes jumps in, and Hughes makes a statement to Luciano that this isn't right. You guys need to make this right because this is kind of crap. Wilkerson's the guy. Don't let your guy do this. And even though Hughes and Siegel had a long-term relationship, and there's some fascinating stuff that Denny and I shared about that connection, is that he didn't like the things that were happening to Wilkerson. Wilkerson was a Hollywood guy. Hollywood people like Billy Wilkerson. So even Ben Siegel knows the power of Howard Hughes. So he gets word that he needs to stand down a little bit, which he does. Now, also keep in mind that in L.A., Jack Dragon is still the Sicilian in charge. And I think a couple things, and I may raise some eyebrows, is I think Ben Siegel and Mickey Pollan get too much credit for what happens in L.A. And, again, it's Sicilian and Sicilian. Luciano's a Sicilian and Dragna's a Sicilian. They take care of each other. That is their code. That is what they live by. So he puts the word out, back off a little bit. Now, the only thing that can hurt Siegel was Hughes. In July of 46, Hughes has his plane crash where he almost dies. And that's on, I want to say that's July 7th of 1946. Within a week, Ben Siegel figures Howard Hughes is going to die like the rest of the country does. Billy Wilkerson is weak without Howard Hughes, so he makes a move on Wilkerson. This is where Siegel really starts to screw up. 1 week after the Hughes crash, what's the worst thing that can happen to organized crime? Publicity. Good for George Raft, bad for Charlie Luciano, Ben Siegel, Maya Lansky. Walter Winchell on his Coast to Coast radio show makes the statement that a West Coast racketeer is trying to muscle a prominent West Coast publisher from his interest in the West Coast hotel. Charlie Luciano has a fit because Charlie Luciano knows that the information Winchell gets came from the director of the FBI, who is J. Edgar Hoover. The FBI is now looking at the business of organized crime. Not good for Ben. Okay, so as we get going, Hughes makes this miraculous recovery. We're going to get to the famous Havana conference. Here's where everybody thinks that Ben Siegel was given the death sentence. And everybody thinks it was because the Flamingo wasn't doing well. Well, the Havana conference was before the hotel even opened up. Ben Siegel, the Flamingo, was discussed, but Ben had his hand in so many other things that he was becoming a concern at this point. Not a problem, but a concern. We had the racetrack. We had the race wire. We had drugs. We had Virginia Hill. And, of course, we had the Flamingo. A couple things in regard to the Flamingo Hotel. By the time the hotel opens, Billy Wilkerson has fled the country fearing for his life. He's out of the country. Big thing, again, go back to Bugsy. It was a flop on opening night. It was horrible. Rain came down. It was awful. Not true. The Flamingo, actually, when you look through the archives, was packed. But it was packed with locals. A lot of the celebrities failed to show up. And it was a gala event, and it lasted for 3 days. The Hollywood people didn't show up. There's a reason for that. By this time, Billy Wilkerson was completely out of the loop. He fled to Paris, was hiding for his life. All those junkets of TWA Airlines that were supposed to fly celebrities into Vegas free of charge were grounded because of weather. Do we remember that from Bugsy?
Yes.
Where it was bad weather, Ben. Who owned TWA?
Howard Hughes.
Thank you, Kim. Howard Hughes. Howard Hughes pulled the plug on the planes going to Las Vegas from L.A. How do I know the weather wasn't bad? I went and I checked the facts. The weather was okay. I looked at the weather report, and I was just laughing because I'm going, okay, he's the greatest pilot in the world, and you're telling me that he's not going to fly a plane because there's trace rain and 3.5-mile-an-hour winds? Amazing stuff when you look at the facts. So Hughes pulls the plug on that. And he does so because he sent in a message that we can destroy this thing. A week and a half after the Flamingo opens, it closes. So Bugsy didn't get called back that night to get killed. This is in December of 46. The Flamingo fails for a lot of reasons. And, you know, the hotel wasn't open. And, again, I know we're going to be short time because we want to get the questions. But the reason it failed is because of Billy Wilkerson's friends. Hollywood pulls all advertising. The L.A. Times and the Los Angeles Herald Examiner and, of course, the Hollywood Reporter, they're not going to advertise. They're not going to promote. The FBI report that I showed Denny states in there that the reason it failed is because of poor publicity. They didn't have the proper publicity. Hughes is sending a message to Luciano. We can end this dream of yours in the desert. Make it right with Wilkerson. By the spring of 47, Ben is in a lot of trouble for a lot of reasons. Now, keep in mind that by March, the Flamingo starts to make a profit. Ben Siegel did not get murdered because he was in debt to the mob for $4, $5, $6 million. That was nothing to them. Ben Siegel's contract was taken out because he was involved in so many other things. The other thing that he did that really bothered people was Jack Dragna ran a pretty good show in L.A. Ben Siegel was very boisterous. That was one reason why they sent him to Vegas. He'd pretty much been out of it, but by then he'd gotten himself into so much trouble that he had to go. In the spring of 47, probably March or April, they make the decision that Benny has got to go bye-bye. Charlie Luciano is the only one who can order this. Now, I've heard Meyer Lansky did this, Meyer Lansky did that. Again, look at the structure of organized crime. That doesn't make any sense. Meyer Lansky is not going to give the order to kill Ben Siegel just because of the fact that Maya was the bookkeeper and a very good bookkeeper. Meyer was also Jewish, which plays into this a little bit, because Luciano is still that Sicilian. Maya Lansky is also Ben Siegel's friend. And even though there's no friends in organized crime, I think by the structure, there's no way that he may have suspected something was coming just because he knew of all the things Ben was in, but he didn't assign the hit. And that's another one of those myths, you know, that Lansky said, if he doesn't succeed with the Flamingo, I'll do it myself. Well, the records show the Flamingo did succeed. Okay, so about this time, we have another incident, a flare-up with Bob McDonald, Betty Ann. Bob's beating him up again, or beat her up again. Here comes Nick to Jack Dragna.
And he wasn't very nice to his son either.
No, he was not, and we'll get that. There's a picture in there, and we put that in there with John, that you know he wasn't outwardly cruel, but there's some indicators that it wasn't a very pleasant relationship. You know, I think John has some very good memories, and I think there's some uncomfortable ones as well. But, you know, for the most part, you're still dealing with a very, very young boy who doesn't really know what's going on in terms of relationships and things along those lines, but he does remember a lot of things. Jack Dragna has this intimate relationship with the McDonald's, and, you know, our families used to go up to Bridgeport and shoot. So after the war, Bob McDonald, my dad, the Dragnas, Nick, they all went to the cabin in Bridgeport and they shot. Bob McDonald is in all this trouble because he's a horrible gambler. You know, we talked about how bad he was in the first part of the show, but Jack Dragna knows that he's got himself the perfect patsy. Now, I know people are going to say, never happened because they wouldn't have used a non-Sicilian, a non-member of organized crime to carry out the crime. That's BS. If you look at the skill set that was required to commit this crime, I dare anybody to give me another situation where a sniper was used. If a sniper was used to kill Bugsy Siegel, you're going to find out when Gangster Squad comes out and when L.A. Noire comes out, Dragna's crime family is criticized because they could never kill Mickey Cohen. If the shooter got away in the Siegel case, and it wasn't Bob McDonald, why didn't they use him to kill Mickey Cohen? Because the shooter was Bob McDonald, and Bob McDonald's dead. So it never happened again. It never happened before. It never happened again. He also knows that if I use Bob McDonald and he gets clipped, he's not going to beat up Betty Ann again. He's in the debt for Jack Dragna for significant money. And it was that piece where Dragna said, I'll cut you a deal. You owe me 30, 40, 50 grand. Whatever it was. Slate's clean if you do this for me. Bob ponders it. He has very low self-esteem, all those reasons we talked about. Says, I'll do it. Now, we've kind of talked about the Siegel killing, and I won't get into the elements of the details about the drop-off, but basically what happens is they make this plan. It's a great plan. Ben Siegel sits on the couch. Alan Smiley sits next to him. A little while later, shots fire out. Alan Smiley dips into the fireplace, Ben Siegel's dead. Let me throw Alan Smiley out again. And we did it the first time, I'm going to do it again. Mm-hmm. If Alan Smylie knew that, okay, here's what's going to happen. I'm going to sit on the couch with Ben. I'm going to make sure he's on the couch. And if somebody's going to shoot either a machine gun or an automatic carbine through that little four-inch hole, and they're not going to hit me because I'm right in the way, I'm good with that plan. I'm not good with that plan. I'm not going to do that. Just by the nature of how the hit happened and what occurred in the house at the time, Alan Smylie was no way involved in the Siegel killing. So, again, we're using evidence and not the myth. There was a newspaper reporter who said Alan Smylie was involved in this murder of his friend, but he didn't base it on any facts. He just kind of threw stuff out there. And, and people believe that. But when you look at the way that the hit occurred, you go, no, he wasn't involved. And Alan Smylie was a pretty heady guy. He wouldn't have put himself in harm's way. It would have been too easy to kill Ben Siegel some other way. You know, you're moving. Put down plastic in front of the couch and shoot him in the back of the head.
Right.
It just didn't make any sense.
No.
So, again, Bob McDonald commits the crime. Brilliant escape, but we'll save that for another time because I know we're running out of time again.
Mm-hmm. And, we've got about 18 minutes.
Perfect. Well, I'm going to try to finish this up so we have time for some questions at the end. But a brilliant plan. One of the other criticisms I get when I mention this is people always ask, okay, so you're saying that there was a 40 caliber machine gun used and there was a 30 caliber carbine used. And my theory on this is that Bob McDonald carries out the hits. There's two escape cars. One goes to the north, one goes to the south. Again, all this is documented. Bob McDonald, if either one of those cars gets stopped and they have a weapon with them, they're going to go to jail, they're going to go to prison, they're going to go to the electric chair for the murder of Ben Siegel. My theory is that Bob McDonald took the weapons and went across the golf course and returned home. It's a mile away. People ask me, I think Denny may even have said this too, is that, boy, a 45 caliber machine gun is pretty heavy, and now you got a carbine. I don't think he could do that. And I always produce that letter. That was what he carried in the battle every single day when he was over in Europe, plus two handguns. He was an infantry officer who carried with him in battle a 45 caliber machine gun and a 30 caliber carbine. Very easy for someone like him to walk a mile home. If the cops stop the cars, they have nothing. They're never going to find him. He's across the golf course in about 52 yards. So amazing stuff. As we all know, the killing brings no changes to the Flamingo, and the Siegel investigation begins in earnest. They start to crank it out. All those organizations that we talk about became involved in the investigation, and for the next 3 months, everything just kind of moves along like an investigation would happen to be. From June 20th to September 13th, that's about a three-month window, the McDonald life is just in ruins. Bob is undergoing psychiatric care at Sawtelle Hospital. It's a veterans facility in Los Angeles. He's going in for depression. He's going in for a variety of concerns. We've never been able to locate those files. I know that I tried. I believe John tried. We don't have access to those, so we don't really know what he was in for. Probably a little post-traumatic syndrome, if they didn't call it that back then. But we also see him to start that deterioration. And if you go into, and this is what you were alluding to, Kim, the photograph that we have on Facebook, you'll see that thumb underneath John's wrist, where it appears to be a very loving person, but he's got this dark side. And it just keeps getting worse and worse. Now, 4 or 5 days before the McDonald murder-suicide, so we're in early September, the McDonalds come over to my parents' house and visit with my mom and dad. And during this time, Betty Ann tells my mom, I'm leaving Bob. Bob tells my dad, by the way, I killed Ben Siegel. Now, there's a little bit more to the story from my dad's perspective because my father actually had given Bob McDonald a 30 caliber carbine that he had brought home, and he did that in the springtime. So at the time, when I first started investigating this, I always thought my father went to his grave believing that the weapon that he gave Bob McDonald was the one that not only killed Ben Siegel, but that killed Betty Ann. And that was hard for him. And as I discovered later, you know, we had a 50-50 shot that it wasn't that weapon because Bob McDonald had his own 30 caliber carbine too. But when the murder-suicide occurs, they take a bunch of weapons from the home. So he was stockpiling weapons for some reason. That night, he gets that ticket that I referred to, you know, where he was speeding and under the influence of a little alcohol. Betty Ann goes to the Archbishop of the church and says, I'm ending this relationship. On Thursday, September 11th, she files court papers. They file court papers that she's leaving. She goes in Friday evening, September 12th, and changes her will. And we know that she changes her will, and she leaves $100,000 to the couple's two children. They had another child shortly after the war, and that was Ellen Gay. And Ellen Gay at the time was 15 or 18 months old. So Betty Ann knows that something bad could happen. Otherwise, why would she change her will and leave her husband out of it? Then, as we all know by now, the tragedy happens on September 13th, and that is the murder-suicide that takes place. Now, as soon as that murder-suicide occurs, we've talked about this, every single police agency, law enforcement agency, and politician in Los Angeles knows that something is very, very wrong. The weapon itself is a giant red flag. So we went back to our BOLO, and we saw those eight items that I talked about. John McDonald was a perfect fit for that BOLO. He should have been somebody that they considered a very, very strong suspect in the Siegel killing. Now, in the hours following the death of their children, Gunnell and Archie were faced with a number of nightmarish decisions. One was, what would happen if anyone ever finds out that Bob was Ben Siegel's killer? There's nothing positive that's going to come of that. You know, sadly, I think one of the main things that they wanted to do to keep this under wraps was protect their social status and their, you know, place in the community. If you read the notice in the paper, it's very, very slanted in towards, you know, he was a war hero coming back and something just went wrong. And that was it. You never hear anything of that again. Now, if you look nowadays, we would just, that answer on TMZ alone would just be, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 months of something of this
right.
magnitude.
And
it's never talked about again. There's not any more newspaper articles. There's a short follow-up newspaper article in one of the minor papers, but the big papers that are owned by Howard Hughes' friends, who are the Chandler family and William Randolph Hearst, they don't do anything with the story. They let it die. And here's where I really think the crux of our theory comes into play.
Mm-hmm.
From the point where Bob McDonald is dead, we have to go back to that 1948 grand jury testimony by the Beverly Hills PD chief, where they say most of what he said means nothing, but there's 1% of the story that is of such significance that a secret investigation would be needed to determine and to close who killed Ben Siegel and close the case. Give me another theory on the Siegel murder that presents a scenario that fulfills that statement. That Chick Hill did it, that Alan Smiley was involved, that Mo Sedway did it. Those guys are all criminals. You can investigate that with regular law enforcement techniques. What would require a secret investigation? Maybe that Hughes was involved. Maybe that the parents have these big-time connections to law enforcement. I always lived with, my parents always used to tell me, sometimes to understand things that seem to be incredible, too incredible to be true, you must first open your mind to what could be possible, no matter how astonishing these possibilities may seem. And I know, as incredible as our story seems, the theory presents a scenario that not only reveals who killed Ben Siegel, but discloses why the murder was never officially solved. They didn't have to solve the crime. Why? Ben Siegel's murderer was dead. There was no legal obligation to name Robert McDonald. It would have put the family in harm's way. These are two people who have a lot of power. This is Gunnell Moretta, who all of these guys who are investigating this, they have some contact with her and very intimate contact in that she knows all of their secrets. Now, they can come out and go, it's the righteous thing to do. We're going to solve this crime, and by God, we don't care what it does to the McDonald family or the Moretta family, who just happen to be two of the most powerful people in Los Angeles. And Howard Hughes at this time, after he defeats the Senate, is probably the most popular and most powerful man in the United States. But we're just going to close the case on this gangster because it's the right thing to do. And by golly, we're LAPD, and we're here, and we're going to solve this. That doesn't fly. So my contention is that I know beyond a reasonable doubt that Robert McDonald murdered Vince Siegel. I also know that Fidel Moretta and Archie McDonald used their wealth, social status, and political influence to make sure nobody else knew that. Now, I've covered a lot in 2 hours, and I'm very grateful for that two-hour time frame.
It's wonderful.
I know you guys have got a ton of questions, but that's our theory on things.
Denny, I just want to start off
a couple of things, Warren, I want to get to and make sure we don't miss.
Sure.
First of all, we talked a little bit about the photos on the, your Facebook site, and one of them is of Robert holding John. They posed for a portrait.
Right.
Can you explain what that picture conveys in your
Yeah, you know, actually, John shared with me, you know, what he was going through. If you look at his face on that, you know, I always look and I said, wow, this is kind of like a halfway between a smile and a frown. And John said, Warren, you know, the reason why I have that look is look at what my dad's doing to my wrist. He's actually bending his wrist back. And I thought that was just a slam dunk that, okay, time out. All right, no father would do something like that to his child. And, you know, you look at John's face and it's so pained. And I know we're running short on time, Denny, but I do want to say one thing. I'm really grateful to a lot of people. Llewellyn Smiley, one of them, she's been so helpful with some things. You know, she really opened her heart and her mind with a lot of things and allowed me to give this similar presentation to her when we met in Las Vegas. And those are the kind of things that are really cool from this story is those relationships and the people that I've met. I met Denny now and shared it. But, you know, the relationship my wife and I now have with our distant cousins and second cousins, John and Joyce McDonald, you know, I wouldn't trade this experience for anything. Am I ever going to prove that this case is true and that John McDonald killed Ben Siegel? I may or may not. But the fact that we have these great connections with these great people, I think the world of John McDonald. My heart goes out to him for all the things that he's had to live with his entire life over this. And one piece that a lot of people don't realize too, and it wasn't in the book that I had written, and you know, Sharon, I know that John wouldn't mind me sharing it because it was on the King 5 deal, is John was there when his father shot his mother. He had come into the room after his father had shot mom, and he experienced something just horrible. Just god awful that none of us can even imagine what he went through, and my heart goes out to him, and you know, I know he's listening, and I just want him to know that this is what this was for me, is that relationship that I have with him now doesn't make anything right, but it makes sense. It makes sense that that's the reason that we had to tell the story, and no other reason, really. So people are either going to believe us or they're not, and I'm okay with that. But I think it's a hell of a story, and I do think it solves the case.
Well, I said initially, I told you after we met, Warren, that I tend to concur with you. You have a very strong argument, I think, make a very strong case. The other thing I wanted to mention, you had actually talked, and now after you completed your research, I don't know if it's ever completed. I know research seems to never end, but you presented your information, your theory to the Beverly Hills Police, didn't you?
Yeah, actually we did. I presented, I would say, about 85%. More information came in, and I've gone down there twice. the last, and it's kind of funny because the last bit of information that we didn't have time to cover, it, I don't think it'll be solved for a number of reasons. And the primary one is because it didn't have to be in 1947, and it doesn't have to be in 2012 or 13. But it doesn't, you know, you look at the Beverly Hills PD, and I kind of feel bad for them because it doesn't paint a very good picture of their department back in that day. They were bullied around a little bit by the LAPD. They, you know, in some FBI files, they really throw the Beverly Hills PD under the bus in the way that they handled some of the evidence and, you know, the way that they were handling the case. And this was one reason, Denny, why they justified diverting the information to the LAPD, is that, you know, in those FBI files that we saw, you saw the memo that was saying, hey, you're not sending anything to Beverly Hills, send it to LAPD. So I don't think they have anything to gain by supporting us. And, you know, there was a time where I thought we were maybe getting close, and then I found this other evidence that I probably should have just kind of kept to myself. But, you know, I gave it to them, and I really haven't heard a whole lot back from them since. So I don't think they have – they have other fish to fry than the murder of Ben Siegel from 65 years ago.
Absolutely. And, you know, the for anybody who thinks that are fetched, that people in powerful positions that have had the kind of clout all these people you mentioned had, Los Angeles, and with the media, I mean, you know, anything even today, if the media decide not to cover a particular story, or what do they call it, giving it legs,
right,
he's going to die. And when you right. had, you know, less media, you didn't have the internet and all this kind of stuff back then, and you had these powerful publishing concerns, and if they decided, for whatever reason, that they weren't going to give this thing any play, mm-hmm. then it was over. I mean, it was
right.
all over. And that
right.
almost happens today.
Right, and when you look at the facts, that's exactly what happened. But I think, too, that part of the problems created by or for Siegel came from the same media sources. When I say that Howard Hughes, you know, I tell people, like, oh, you're saying Howard Hughes was involved in the Ben Siegel killing. I'm not saying that at all. But what I am saying is that there were elements of what Hughes was doing that really gave the mob cause for concern. Howard Hughes and his relationships with Walter Winchell, who did radio coast to coast with the LA Times and with Hearst, who had, you know, media outlets everywhere, they had the ability to destroy whoever they could. They can either kill people with bad press or with no press. You know, you can make things go away with good press, and you can magnify things with bad press. And in the end, I think that's what got Ben Siegel killed, was that they were going to turn the heat up on him, be it radio, be it TV, or not TV, be it movies, be it the press. And it was just something that Charlie Luciano couldn't do anymore.
And, yeah, and that obviously was, again, with these players and with their power, and it wouldn't have, as you were saying, advanced much to possibly run afoul of all these powerful, I'm talking about the PD, if they wanted to say,
sure,
well, we fight no matter what. Well, you know, there are certain wars you can't win. And
correct.
At that stage of the game, to accomplish when the shooter is already dead,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, the believed shooter is already dead, to open up that can of worms, that hornet's nest, and,
yeah.
you know, and people who are big employers and so forth, it really
right.
wouldn't have made a lot of sense for the PD, even if they wanted to.
To
open that can of worms, at least I don't believe
And I'll
it.
Leave you a great
right.
statement from Robert Mayhew, who, as you know, Denny, was with Howard Hughes here in Vegas, and I had an opportunity to talk to him. Robert Mayhew said, yeah, this is a theory that I really believe that could have happened. He didn't know much about it, but he said, Warren, let me tell you the piece that Howard Hughes always shared with me, and I know from personal experience, this is Robert Mayhew talking, that it's true. Howard Hughes stated, and it's public knowledge, that there is not a man that I cannot either buy or destroy. And I thought that was a powerful statement, because that's exactly how life in the big city and life with these people is. They're either going to buy you or they're going to destroy you. And I think it was easy to do both back in 1947 Los Angeles, especially when you consider that legally nobody broke a law. It's not a conspiracy. It was just the thing to do.
Powerful, scary, and true. Warren, we're out of time. We're going to have to leave it right there. I want to thank you so much. It's just been a fascinating 2 hours we've spent here. And listen, if anything ever changes, you get any updates or anything, please let us know. We'll have you back on.
Absolutely. We'd love to. Kim, thank you. Denny, thank you. And we appreciate it.
Warren, thank you so much. And I just want to say thank you to John McDonald, who is just it's so instrumental in this. And thank you, John, and thank you, Joyce, and Llewellyn. Thanks, Llewellyn.
Yeah.
Wonderful lady.
All good people. All good people.
All good people.
Again, it's these kind of things that make these journeys so worthwhile. It's not the destination,
exactly. It's
the journey.
Exactly.
And thanks
good
so
deal.
Much to Director of Research Kim Colton and Public Relations Team at ImaginePublicity.com. Our next show will begin Tuesday, December 18th, with our new start time of 7 p.m. Eastern. 2 minutes to continue to analyze cases that wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice, and discuss crime-related topics with the experts. To hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show, go to www.crimewire.blogspot.com. Turn on the volume at your computer, and the show will automatically play. Until next time, God bless and stay safe. Good night, everybody.
Good night.